This episode of The Dig is supported by The Nation. 150 years of political analysis and progressive solutions online and in print. The Dig listeners can head to thenation.com/dig to get a 6-month subscription to The Nation for only $12. That's thenation.com/dig. Check out this episode's program notes for that URL if you don't have a pen handy. Also, be sure to listen to The Nation's podcast, Start Making Sense, hosted by John Weiner. New episodes every Thursday. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. There is perhaps nothing that so exposes Donald Trump as a snake oil salesman as the fact that he ran a campaign pitched at white working class anger at so-called globalism, and then stacked his administration with representatives from big finance, most notably from the great vampire squid Goldman Sachs. A decade after Wall Street blew up the global economy, it is now very much in the driver's seat in doing what it does best. And that is to ensure that global capitalism is maximally structured to act as a giant vacuum cleaner that descends from the economic sky and sucks up as much wealth as possible from regular people and redistributes it upward to the super rich. Today, my guest is David Dayan, a journalist who trenchantly covers finance for a number of outlets, including The Intercept and The New Republic. He is also the author of a book you should definitely check out, Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David will walk us through the current political economic position of big finance and offer some thoughts on how its hold on power can be broken. David Dayan, welcome to The Dig.
Thanks for having me on.
So most people who aren't bankers, I think, detest big banks, yet finance is structured in such a way so that its workings can be pretty inscrutable to the very people who most need to understand it. I'm a journalist. I don't cover finance, but you'd still think it would be a little less difficult for me to understand what's going on after picking up the paper in the morning. So just to start, what, a decade after the financial crisis, is the big picture about big finance that you think it's important for people to understand?
Well, I think the first important thing to understand is that you really can't escape big finance. You cannot separate it from the other sort of machinations in corporate America, all of which are financial forms of financial engineering in some sense. I mean, Apple right now has hundreds of billions of dollars that they've stashed overseas, and they're using borrowing instead of tapping that source of funds because it offers them tax advantages. So that is a form of financial engineering and really a form of financialization. And what we've seen is that these kinds of efforts have grown massively, and not just over the last 10 years, but over the last 30 or 40 years, so that practically every company in, you know, the Fortune 500 is at some level a financial institution. I mean, some of that was very directly things like GE Capital, which was the finance arm of General Electric, or GMAC, which was the initial financing arm of General Motors. It started for their cars, for General Motors in the case of GM, and in the case of GE Capital, to fund their specific manufacturing products. But those things grew and migrated over time. In fact, GMAC was one of the largest mortgage servicing companies and one of the most corrupt, I should add, at the time of the financial crisis. So first of all, you have that sort of migration. Second of all, you have the use of these financial instruments by these large operators. You know, I mean, one of the reasons that Southwest Airlines became preeminent among low-cost carriers was their use of hedging, which is a type of derivative, in order to secure contracts for jet fuel. And then the third thing you have is the use of private equity firms, largely, to buy out so many core businesses that you don't think of as financial companies. And, you know, the private equity firms use them through various forms of maneuvering and engineering, like saddling these companies with debt, like using sale leaseback strategies to actually take away their properties and then lease them back to them, all sorts of financial maneuvers to extract value out of these companies and give it to their particular investors. So it's not just banks. That would, I think, be the core thing that you have to get across here. It's the entire system of corporate America, which has become financialized, and that is seen as the end goal to profit rather than creating a good product that people might want.
That's a really important point. Do you think it's fair to say that it was the growing power and abuses of big finance that caused the financial crisis, but the financialization of the rest of American capitalism as a whole that made Americans so vulnerable to the crash when it happened?
Well, I think maybe in part that's true. I mean, what we saw in the crisis was you know, sort of a large financial engineering scheme, in this case, securitization of mortgages, turning mortgages into a tradable instrument. And that was done over about a 30-40 year period with the help of members of both parties, presidencies of both parties, to change the rules so that private interests could get involved in this trading and securitization of mortgages, rather than the way it was previously, which was these government-sponsored entities of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac using securitization to acquire more money that could be plowed back into the mortgage market. In this case, it was private businesses trying to get a piece of that action. And when they did, they fueled a large bubble that was fated to pop, since they, in order to keep up with it, they were handing out mortgages to more and more people who didn't really have the means to pay. Underwriting standards completely crashed, and we know what happened next. So in that sense, yes, it's true. In another sense, I think you could also say that the way in which labor and productivity have severed since the late 1970s put working Americans sort of on a treadmill where in order to keep up with higher costs of living amid stagnant wages, they, you know, sought an attempt to make up for that first in borrowing through maybe credit cards, then through borrowing through their homes and the various speculative instruments that were done, that were created in order to do that. The cash out refinance, which was a way to sort of use your home as an ATM, was really the preeminent instrument and vehicle that was used in the housing bubble. It wasn't people buying six or seven homes. It was using the initial home and capitalizing on the increase in home values to actually take out money. And usually that money was used to pay for necessities because they couldn't do it otherwise. So yeah, I think you can say that this drive for profit, this use of financial engineering, this tyranny of shareholder value, and the idea that shareholders have to be paid off first before workers can, that led to this sort of treadmill effect where families could really have had nowhere else to turn once they had two incomes working through both parents. To use this securitization instrument to sort of feed into it by using their homes as money machines. And so I think you can say that financialization played a large role in the crash, the financialization of American capitalism, and continues to play a role in these very sclerotic recovery that we've seen, and I think Larry Summers has referred to as secular stagnation, this idea that wages sort of remain constant at a very low level, that don't increase very much, and that we see this tremendous amount of regional inequality. In addition to, you know, regular income and wealth inequality, we're seeing entire regions be left behind. And I think that all is part of this piece.
I think that's an incredibly important point because, I mean, it's broadly understood that schemes on Wall Street involving mortgage securitization played a huge role in the financial crisis and the broader economic crisis that followed. But the bigger picture is that workers with stagnant or declining wages, widening income inequality over the past few decades as unions are being busted and executive compensation is skyrocketing, that Wall Street could only do this because Americans were forced to debt finance their existence, to paper over the huge hit that their income was taking.
That's right. It's very important. It was out of necessity. You really wouldn't have seen the record numbers of this rise of $1 trillion in subprime loans in 2005 and 2006. Were it not out of necessity, were it not because people just to subsist needed some form of bubble to capture a subsistence level of maintaining their standard living. I think that's a key part of the sort of big picture here. And then the other big picture is this extreme concentration that we're seeing in all of these sectors across our economy. And financialization plays a key role in that. Mergers and acquisition has become sort of one of the main profit centers for Wall Street. Number one. Number two, I've already mentioned sort of the private equity roll-up and how that sort of, concentrates ownership in fewer and fewer hands. And all of these things sort of drive this ability to, you know, number one, capture rents, the ability to, make your money not through providing a better product, but being, you know, one of the few people, few industries or particular companies within that industry that people can turn to acquire that product or service. And you also see this play out regionally because if the power and wealth is concentrated and actual markets are concentrated in fewer hands, those are located in very specific areas. And this is why we see the decrease in sort of economic dynamism across the country. And we see the hollowing out of large swaths of the country, whether in the Midwest or in Appalachia or in the South. So I think these things all play together, and they all have at their core this idea of this concept of big money, of shareholder tyranny, of financialization. Those sort of sit atop what we're seeing throughout the economy, I think. And for workers, it becomes more and more difficult to maintain without assuming a certain level of risk. And what we saw in the crisis is that risk ultimately became, completely toxic. And what we saw in the aftermath is that all of the losses that were through this system of securitization were allocated on the individual families and homeowners themselves with very few consequences for the banks or their top officers. Really no consequences, I think it's fair to say.
You cover big finance full time and do a really excellent job explaining what's going on Wall Street to those of us who don't do what you do for a living, but it's pretty often the machinations of big finance are pretty mystifying, I think, to a lot of people. A lot of coverage of finance and Wall Street is relegated to the business section. It's not even called the economy section. It's the business section because it's for businessmen to read.
Right.
Do you think the inscrutability is an accident?
No, it's not an accident at all. I think these corporations thrive on creating this myth that they're the only ones who understand what's going on. In actuality, these things are sort of dolled up in jargon, like any industry has jargon, but it's a little easier, I think, to discern once you recognize the patterns. So you're absolutely right to say that these things get relegated to the business pages, and sometimes I see my role is as elevating things on the business pages and providing the context and analysis necessary to understand them as political maneuvers and political arguments and things that everybody should be interested in and involved in. So that's kind of what I do, I think, in some respects, is provide the proper context to a lot of these various schemes and understand how they're being used at the expense of workers, at the expense of investors, ordinary retail investors, and at the expense of our broader economy.
I think this intentional inscrutability of big finance and Wall Street also plays a role in giving people from Wall Street this aura of the smart guys in the room. The only people who can regulate the system are the people who've worked in it. And so shifting to the current administration, and I think this is the longest I've gone in any interview since the election without mentioning his name, but Donald Trump ran a campaign, that was characterized as fairly hostile to Wall Street, but his administration is now loaded with high-ranking Wall Street personnel. Can you guide us through who those Wall Street figures in the Trump administration are and what they're trying to accomplish?
Sure. So probably the biggest at this point is Gary Cohn, and he is the head of the National Economic Council, which is an entity inside the White House. And one reason why he has sort of leaped to the top in terms of power and influence is that by being inside the White House, he can hire underlings and subsequent personnel without having to go through the Senate confirmation process. So while Trump has sort of agonized and done a pretty poor job of staffing the federal government through various agencies, Gary Cohn hasn't had that problem. He's been able to, pick up his subordinates and install them, right away. And so that has given him the base to make these arguments inside the administration and sort of in the combat with, a Steve Bannon. Cohn has had a lot of ammunition and he's been available to, he's been able to put his message forward. And that message really is a pretty common, I'd say, Republican message, conservative message of tax cuts and massive deregulation. We're certainly seeing deregulation across the financial sphere. That plays into the people who have been nominated and confirmed at the various agencies. Of course, you have Steve Mnuchin. He's the Treasury Secretary, and he was the partner at Goldman Sachs, then ran his own hedge fund, became the CEO of a bank called One West that was right in the middle of the foreclosure abuses that we saw after the collapse of the housing bubble. You have Jay Clayton, who's the head of the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. He was a lawyer for a number of financial industry clients at a white shoe law firm called Sullivan & Cromwell. His biggest client was Goldman Sachs, and that name keeps popping up again and again, right? So you also have this guy at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and this one is really interesting. So the OCC is one of the largest banking regulators. I'd say the Federal Reserve is number one, and number two would be the OCC. They regulate
and OCC's name recognition is
of the
yeah.
currency. Yeah, its
name recognition is probably like at 2 or 3%.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, nobody knows who they are, but they regulate all the top national banks, and it's an independent agency. But the term of Obama's head of the OCC ended in May. And instead of having to go through the confirmation process, what the Trump administration did was find this guy, another corporate lawyer named Keith Noriega, off the street, and they immediately made him a position you didn't have to confirm. They call him the first deputy of the OCC. And then when Thomas Curry, who was Obama's head, had to resign because his term ended, they just made Noriega the acting head of the OCC. And this is a guy who's had no vetting. He had active clients as of, you know, just months ago, including all of the top banks, practically on Wall Street. And he was thrown into this position, and they would use this terminology called a special government employee, which meant that he doesn't have to abide by these strictures where, if you leave government service for a year, you can't lobby the government on particular issues that you dealt with, or you can't for 5 years engage in lobbies on behalf of foreign government, or all these other kind of impediments to the revolving door. He elides all of those just by being a special government employee. And if he goes back into the private sector, this is kind of the insidious part of it, Noriega would then have a resume builder saying that I ran the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and I understand and got an education in all of the bank examination that goes on through OCC, and I can bring that wisdom to you, my client, in trying to evade government regulations, which was sort of his job as a corporate lawyer for all these Wall Street banks prior to being the head of the OCC. So it's almost like a short-term rental that they're doing so that this guy can not only boost his resume, but sort of be a political intelligence mechanism to bring back to Wall Street all of this wealth of information of what the examiners know and what they don't and what they look at and what they don't see. So it's quite remarkable. And I feel like I've only scratched the surface of some of the various players within this. But Noriega is one that hasn't really been high profile, but is really kind of wild.
Hey, this is Dan Denver, your faithful host. I started this podcast a few months back as an experiment. I had no idea what would happen. Today, we have between 12,000 and 15,000 listeners each week. And irony of ironies, it turns out that starting a socialist podcast entails starting a small business, albeit a really, really tiny one. And that means having to generate revenue. One big way that's happening is on Patreon.com, where 235 people and counting are already making contributions. If you like the show, please go to patreon.com. Search for The Dig, and contribute a few bucks, and help us reach our goal of 1,000 supporters at some point in the next year. You also may have noticed that we've had some ads recently by publishers at Oxford University Press and University of California Press, who both put out loads of great books. I'm working now to bring more publishers on board. If you work for a publisher, please get in touch. There is no better podcast to reach a hardcore group of leftists who like reading serious books. If you write books, please contact your publisher and encourage them to support the podcast. Our interviews showcase the best lefty writers, and our ads do the same. And now back to the show. So what's the Trump administration's regulatory, or I guess it's probably deregulatory, agenda when it comes to Wall Street, and what have they done so far?
Yeah. So, I think the biggest thing that the Trump administration has done is simply call off the dogs when it comes to enforcement. There were some things that were in the pipeline, you know, through law enforcement, Department of Justice, that they sort of wrapped up and did it in the least disruptive way possible. But it really doesn't matter what laws are on the books if you don't have people installed at these various agencies who are willing to actually, you know, monitor them and oversee them. One thing that we've seen is, you know, the Federal Reserve giving this continued delay to this thing called the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule is one of the largest parts of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, which is sort of under assault at all sides by Republicans. And while it's a fairly flawed law, the Volcker Rule, the entire purpose is to stop deposit-taking companies from essentially gambling with depositor money, from using their own accounts to do what is called proprietary trading, risky trading, using the depositor funds as a cheap source of funding. So under this rule, all of the trades and vehicles that violated this standard of not doing proprietary trading were supposed to be sold off. All the banks were supposed to unwind all of these large trades and their investments in things like hedge funds in order to comply with the Volcker Rule. Well, the Federal Reserve has given three separate delays. The most recent delay, which was done this year, allowed an additional 5 years to unwind these trades. So a law that was written in 2010 now doesn't have to be complied with respect to the Volcker Rule until 2022. And so you just see the absurdity of claiming that there's still a law on the books when they just endlessly delay and delay and delay the effective implementation date. So that's an example of how if you just sort of walk off the field, what's written down in the federal statutes really doesn't matter. So, I mean, I think that's the one main thing. The second part of the agenda is sort of this preparation to overturn a lot of the rules in Dodd-Frank. An executive order that Trump signed called for the review by the Treasury Secretary of pretty much every federal regulation around the financial industry and recommendations for what to do about them. Now, that review is due actually June 3rd. We're speaking on May 31st. The Treasury Department, since they have almost no staff that's been confirmed, has already said that they're not going to get that done by June 3rd. They're going to do it in stages. But they're specifically looking at a series of different laws, guidance, regulations, and what they can do is they can sort of subtly, within the limits of the statute, change the guidance and change the interpretive regulation that's attached to these statutes to soften the blow. You know, so much of Dodd-Frank was left sort of open to interpretation from the various federal regulators. And so it's just a matter of the Treasury Department or the FDIC or the Federal Reserve or any of these federal banking regulators to take a second look at the way that these things were already interpreted and change them. Now, that's a pretty laborious process. That takes 2 to 3 years usually to go through the regulatory gauntlet. You got to file notice. You have to ask for public comment, and all of those things take time. However, you know, in the meantime, you're not enforcing most of the laws on the books anyway. And the second thing is that by the time the Obama administration got out of office, still about one third of all Dodd-Frank regulations were not written. They were not completed at the time that Donald Trump was inaugurated. And so the other very easy thing that you can do is just not move forward on all of these various statutorily mandated regulations that are supposed to be done. And once you don't do that, you know, one third of Dodd-Frank is sort of wiped out. The final thing you can do is through Congress, and that's sort of a two-pronged approach. Number one, during the first 5 months or so of the administration, they used this thing called the Congressional Review Act, which is a very obscure law. It's only been used once before in history prior to Donald Trump, and it allows the House and Senate to roll back through a resolution by a majority vote any regulations that they disagree with that were done within the previous 60 days of the prior administration. Now, that's 60 legislative days, so these so-called midnight rules that they were able to overturn from Obama actually went back to June of 2016. And they did this 14 times, and a couple of those were rules that affected the financial industry. One of them was around disclosure for oil and gas firms on the payments that they made to foreign governments. This was in Dodd-Frank. They no longer have to make that disclosure to the United States, so that helps oil and gas companies hide what they're doing in foreign countries.
Like bribes.
Exactly. Another one was really just a complete wet kiss to the financial industry. It said that if states wanted to set up these state-based retirement accounts for workers in the states that did not have access to, say, a 401k or a defined benefit pension, there was, I think eight states put together these state-based retirement account programs. And there was some regulation from the Department of Labor that enabled this to happen without conflicting with various federal laws. And those were rolled back. So it looks like these state programs, you know, states go through the laboratories of democracy, but apparently not when they might, affect the financial industry's ability to capture, private retirement accounts. So those got rolled back. And the final thing I would say is, in terms of what the regulatory agenda is that once all of these recommendations get made for what to do about deregulation, if you want to put those, sort of into the statutes, you're going to have to pass a law. And the House has moved forward through the Financial Services Committee on a thing called the CHOICE Act. And what the CHOICE Act would do is, by its name, give financial institutions a choice. And the choice would be they could roll back pretty much all regulations from Dodd-Frank. All they would have to do is put together what is known as a leverage requirement. Leverage is a ratio, essentially, between borrowing and equity. If you have a 10% leverage ratio, that means you can lend out $100 and borrow 90 of those dollars. So you're leveraging that money. So the idea is that if you have a higher leverage ratio, you don't need any of the other regulations because the banks would have to pay for their own mistakes. They would absorb the loss through their capital. The problem with that is that 10% is woefully inadequate to that task. And the way that the CHOICE Act sets it up is it says, well, you have to have a 10% leverage ratio, but if you don't, we'll give you a year and then we'll check again. So there's no enforcement. There's really no penalty for not having this leverage ratio. So it's equivalent to not even having to have it at all. And so the CHOICE Act is really a choice of nothing in exchange for turning in so many of these various rules that were set up after the financial crisis.
Two follow-ups on that. The first, isn't it the late Justice Scalia's son who's been at the lead in fighting rulemaking on Dodd-Frank?
Indeed. Eugene Scalia is sort of seen as the super lawyer to the banking industry. One case that I've been tracking that I will have something coming out in the next print edition of the New Republic is he's working on this thing with MetLife to try to get them off from this designation as a systemically important financial institution. In Dodd-Frank, it sets up this panel of regulators that can designate any non-bank any bank with more than $50 billion in assets, and also any non-bank, as a systemically important institution. And what that means is it has higher capital requirements, it has more stringent regulation. It essentially says you guys are so important that your failure would cause mass disruption to the economy and the financial system, and so we're going to put you under the microscope. Well, MetLife didn't like being under the microscope, and so they hired Eugene Scalia. And Eugene Scalia has argued in court that the process that this panel, known as the Financial Stability Oversight Council, or FSOC, put forward was inadequate. It was improper. And they got a federal judge to agree with them last year. However, there was an appeal, and it looked like the appeals court was going to rule. And then the Trump administration wrote this executive order telling the Treasury Secretary to review the process for this Financial Stability Oversight Council, of which the Treasury Secretary is the chair, and review it under factors that were in the very factors that this federal judge said invalidated the MetLife case. And then Eugene Scalia took that executive order, brought it to the appeals court, and said, you have to delay your ruling because the Treasury Department is looking at the process here. So this was like MetLife almost buying an executive order from the Trump administration with the help of Eugene Scalia. Now, what are the connections here? MetLife gave $100,000 to the Trump inaugural committee. Eugene Scalia's law firm, Gibson Dunn, had two transition officials on the Trump transition team. So it's very clear to me that they sought help with this, what they thought was going to be an adverse ruling from an appeals court. And the Trump administration dutifully stepped in with an executive order that was almost tailored and customized to be used to help out MetLife in this litigation. It's absolutely amazing, and it's just one of many ways in which Eugene Scalia has put himself forward on these various regulatory matters with respect to the financial industry.
What a family. My second follow-up is on the Fed delaying implementation of the Volcker mm-hmm. rule, which you mentioned. The Fed obviously is governed in this very complicated way. Is this delay due to Trump making his malign influence felt in the Fed, or is this due to problems internal to the Fed?
I would say that's due to problems internal to the Fed. Now, the Trump administration has nominated what they call the vice chair of supervision. This would be the point person at the Fed for all financial regulations. And of course, the Fed may be the most important bank supervisor out there. And their choice is familiarly deregulatory in his very nature. However, he's not there yet. He's only been nominated. He hasn't been confirmed. I believe, this is the third delay of the Volcker rule that we've seen from the Federal Reserve. And the previous two were under the Obama administration and under handpicked Obama administration officials like Janet Yellen and others. The culture at the Fed, right, over the last decades, it has been to have a somewhat light touch on regulation. You're seeing a lot of, in fact, at the staff level, a lot of the acolytes of Alan Greenspan are still really entrenched at the Fed. Scott Alvarez, who is the general counsel of the Federal Reserve, he left this year, but prior to that, he was an extremely malign influence on what the Fed was doing, particularly on financial regulation. And he was a holdover from the Greenspan years. So, there's a cultural shift that needs to happen at the Fed. However, who Trump is going to bring in to be that financial supervising point person, it does not look good for that cultural change to happen right away.
Alan Greenspan's deep state at the Fed. Who in the Fed is fighting the good fight amongst the governors?
Well, that's also a problem because the previous point person for financial regulation, a guy named Daniel Tarullo, quit because I assume because he saw that his you know, all his authority was going to be taken away from him. So he's done. He was, you know, generally a pretty decent figure in terms of trying to move forward, but he was fighting his own agency in terms of the bureaucratic kind of infighting, and he would sort of choose his battles, and he did increase some of the capital requirements on the largest financial institutions. And did a couple other things that were laudatory. However, you know, there was always sort of a battle within the Federal Reserve, and now he's gone. So it's unclear to me who is available at the Fed to really be that point person that's going to be a counterpoint to the forces that Trump is going to unleash.
There was a lot of people on the left were pretty hopeful about Sarah Bloom Raskin, correct?
Well, she was a very good governor on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, but then she left to take a job at the Treasury Department. She was, at the end of the Obama administration, the number two or number three official at the Treasury Department. She was replaced, essentially, by Lael Brainard, who was a Timothy Geithner acolyte. Who was at Treasury, had a particular interest in financial, international financial institutions. And she moved into Raskin's seat at the Fed. And you know, there's sort of an unofficial rule on the Fed Board of Governors. It's kind of like the Super Friends. Like there's a seat for every particular discipline. There's supposed to be an academic seat, a community banker seat, and Raskin's was really sort of the public interest seat. And when Brainard took that over, they sort of eliminated that seat. And there were subsequent vacancies on the board, and Obama did seek to fill those vacancies, but that expired basically. The Republicans in the Senate did not move on those nominations. And so the subsequent nominations are all going to come from Trump. So the public interest seat on the Fed, which was the one that was more interested in consumer protection, that was interested in the rights of small shareholders and sort of all of the things you don't normally hear about at the Federal Reserve, that seat got eliminated within the Obama administration, and I don't think it's coming back.
Stepping back a little, obviously we've talked about how Republicans want to eviscerate Dodd-Frank, which Obama signed into law in 2010. Can you mm-hmm. walk us through what Dodd-Frank is and to what degree it addressed the underlying issues that led to the financial crisis? And to what degrees it fell short?
Absolutely. So Dodd-Frank was this law that was put in place in July of 2010. And after the financial crisis, I think the group of financial regulatory reformers that you see today, many of which have very wide-ranging, expansive ideas for what you could actually do to make the financial system safer, whether it's reinstituting the Glass-Steagall law that would create a firewall between investment and commercial banks, or just sort of ring fence those assets, there are a number of these kinds of proposals out there. Those people didn't really have it all together at the time that Dodd-Frank was being debated. And they lost a number of the key fights on Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank was really Tim Geithner's vision. It's very technocratic in nature. It tries to sort of tweak the system that we had rather than overhaul it. And it put a ton of discretion into the regulatory agencies, who then had to figure out what the specific language would be on a lot of the rules that were sort of vaguely hinted at within Dodd-Frank. So you have two problems here. Number one, it's a sort of technocrat's dream where you can sort of dial in the right amount of regulation and somehow prevent crises. And number two, it's all of this discretion that you put in the hands of regulators who can then change those interpretations at their discretion. And those are, I think, the two weaknesses of Dodd-Frank. Now, it did have strength. The one new agency, the one new framework that it really created was the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau,
which you've called an oasis amid a sea of deregulation.
There you go. So this was the brainchild of Elizabeth Warren before she was a senator. She came up with this idea, and it took all of the very disparate consumer protection responsibilities out there and centralized them in one agency that was actually dedicated to looking out for the consumer, which wasn't really done before. Previous agencies that had consumer protection responsibility also was thinking about the safety and soundness of the banks. And so that would seemingly always take precedence over consumer protection. So I think CFPB has been successful, maybe not the most successful it could be, but moderately successful, returning billions of dollars to individuals who've been harmed by financial institutions, creating several standards on things as disparate as prepaid cards, mortgage servicing, mandatory arbitration, and a host of other rules and regulations that they've standardized and streamlined. So that's an example of sort of the one area where Dodd-Frank actually did do a reorganization and overhaul. And there are other things that are positive about Dodd-Frank. However, I would just fall back on these two core weaknesses, the discretionary aspect, and also the weakness around it being a sort of technocratic tweak rather than an overhaul of the system.
And Republicans, obviously, and Wall Street hate the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Yes. Yeah, they want to dismantle it. They want to dismantle it. They want its budget put into the appropriations process so they can then starve that budget. Right now, the budget is protected. It's part of the Federal Reserve. And so, yes.
And they want to change proposals. They want to change its governance as well.
They want to change its governance structure from a single director to a 5-person bureau. Or a panel, which we see in a number of other places. This is just trying to diffuse that out. Now, they may hold back on that because it's easier to replace one person than it is five. And this time next year, July 2018, Richard Cordray, who's the director of CFPB, his term is up. Obviously, Donald Trump is not going to renominate Richard Cordray to another 5 years at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So what is likely to happen is he'll put somebody in who is thoroughly disinterested in enforcing consumer protection laws. Voila, you've sort of gutted the agency from within. Now, obviously, it would be more sustainable and durable if you did something structural like what you said, whether it's overhauling the governance structure or changing the appropriations. But that's a pretty good fallback plan to just hire a CFPB director who is not interested in consumer protection.
Stepping back to talk about the politics of some of this, it's really remarkable how much power Wall Street retains a decade after the crash, after anger over Wall Street fueled both Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party and Bernie Sanders and Trump, weirdly enough, as that turns out. How did Wall Street manage to maintain so much sway during the most intense political headwinds you could imagine them facing?
Well, they sort of kept their head down. They recognized that the legislative fight was only half the battle. So when Dodd-Frank passed, they obviously worked to water down Dodd-Frank as much as they could in Congress, but they realized that that was only the beginning, that they could go behind the scenes into these regulatory agencies, and many of which are staffed with their former colleagues, and use their influence there really under the radar to undermine these various protections, regardless of their public profile. Now, their public profile really has not improved terribly much. Just look to the Wells Fargo account scandal to see how, the sort of fervor at Wall Street has only grown since the financial crisis. Interestingly, in the aftermath of the Wells Fargo scandal, John Stumpf, who was their CEO, actually had to resign, which is something we really didn't see in the aftermath of a much larger crisis created by Wall Street in 2008. So that ability for the grassroots and for individuals in Congress to really fight and whip up a frenzy around the financial industry, it still exists in kind of a latent form. And when you see things like Wells Fargo take place, it comes to the fore, and it's stronger than it was before. Just looking at the makeup of the Democratic caucus, in the aftermath of 2008, you didn't have an Elizabeth Warren or even a Bernie Sanders sort of lurching the caucus to the side of stronger and tougher regulations on the industry. Whereas now it would be very difficult for any member of the Democratic caucus, at least in the Senate, to really speak out on behalf of Wall Street. Even the minority leader, Chuck Schumer, has sort of temper his rhetoric around that. So in some ways, things are improved in terms of that. However, one thing we know is that the financial industry has a lot of money, has a lot of power, has the ability to sort of get in the crevices, work behind the scenes to ensure that they aren't terribly affected or held accountable for any of the things that they do. And in the Trump administration now, and in Republicans in Congress, they have a very important ally to move that forward.
This episode of The Dig is supported by The Nation, 150 years of political analysis and progressive solutions online and in print. The Dig listeners can head to thenation.com/dig to get a 6-month subscription to The Nation for only $12. That's thenation.com/dig. Check out this episode's program notes for that URL if you don't have a pen handy. Also, be sure to listen to The Nation's podcast, Start Making Sense, hosted by John Weiner. New episodes every Thursday.
Hey, this is Bhaskar Sankara, editor of Jacobin. I know everyone has a podcast these days, but The Dig and Dan Dunfer are really, really good. And Dan needs your help to help pay the people who work on the show and reproduce their labor power. And as every Marxist knows, it's very important. To support this show, go to patreon.com and look up The Dig. That's Patreon, patreon.com. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Looking back, do you think that if Obama had cracked down harder on Wall Street, including with criminal prosecutions, do you think that might have prevented far-right anti-globalists and libertarians from picking up so much of the anti-Wall Street energy in the wake of 2008?
Absolutely. I think that this was sort of the biggest mistake of Obama's presidency. I think it's created a sort of tear in our social fabric to have this situation where we had this massive crisis built on a mountain of fraud that was demonstrable, and nobody is held accountable for it. It speaks to this sort of rot in the heart of our democracy, which is actually the first line of the book that I wrote last year before the Trump election, that this sort of nagging unrest, this discontent with this two-tiered system of justice that we appear to have in this country, I do think helped lead to Trump's rise and his co-opting of that argument that they were the ones on the side of the ordinary worker against the sort of elite superstructure that of which the financial industry was a part. I think that there was a lot that could have been done. There were a lot of mistakes made. I think that the very design of many of these programs that were attempted to help homeowners, for example, because of the nature of them, they weren't universal. They weren't they diffused the responsibility down to private companies to decide whether or not homeowners got relief. And so the face of the biggest government program, or one of the big ones under Obama, was a mortgage servicing company that actually had incentives to screw the average homeowner. That was a severe blow to liberalism. So, you know, there are a lot of ways in which this failure, this core failure of accountability, really did lead to the rise of what we're seeing today.
Getting closer to the end of the interview, I want to move just to some like grab bag things that I want to get your take on that have to do with finance.
Okay.
One is something that's been in the news a lot since Trump took office is the so-called Trump bump, which refers to the stock market blowing up amidst all this investor excitement over Trump being president. And now that bump is deflating. What do you make of this? Is this example of the market's faith in animal spirits, or were they placing more rational bets that turned out to be wrong, but rational bets on a unified Republican government that they believed would deliver a lot more than they've been able to deliver in Congress?
I think it's the latter. I mean, I think it's they assumed that with unified Republican control, that would be good for business in two core ways: lower taxes and more deregulation. Now, there has been more deregulation. The lower taxes is being held up. It's sort of sequenced in line behind whatever they're going to do on healthcare, and as you know, the sort of air of scandal has engulfed the Trump administration. I think investors are more and more wary of whether there will be any kind of tax legislation that will pass at all. So I think that's part of it. I think the second part of it is that what we have seen corporate profits rise over the last, you know, since the Trump election. Part of it on anticipation of these changes, and part of it on real tangible gains in terms of lower compliance costs, because the likelihood of being targeted in a regulatory environment is lower. And so we've already seen those profits rise, and we've seen investors, you know, sort of build that up. But that cannot be a sort of perpetual motion machine. I just don't think that even the investors themselves, certainly, and these large companies believe that they can sustain that level forever. And we're seeing some softening in terms of consumer spending and things like that. So there are some fundamental reasons why the Trump bump has sort of petered out. But I think the main reason is, as you described, this loss of faith that there will be this transformation that will be very business friendly through legislative action.
But yeah, while the Trump bump lasted, it was incredible propaganda for the Trump administration. It was in the New York Times every day or so. I'm sure on CNN.
And it fed. Yeah. I mean, it fed this myth that Republicans are good for business, as if the only way to sort of designate good for business is whether or not you completely eliminate regulations and lower taxes, that those are the only criteria that you need in order to judge whether the business environment is friendly or not.
As well as this mistaken idea that the way we evaluate the health of the American economy as the whole is by looking at Wall Street and how it's doing.
Exactly, looking at the stock market. So that is another major factor in all of this. And certainly Trump has said that because it's one of the few indicators that he can point to that reflect positively upon him. So he has certainly conflated the stock market with the economy at every step.
My other grab bag issue is what's going on in Puerto Rico right now. It's hard to think of a single sadder case of ordinary people's economic interests and big finance being opposed as Puerto Rico, which is only sometimes covered as part of the United States, which it is in the U.S. media. They're currently undergoing a bankruptcy-like process that's not technically bankruptcy. And massive, devastating austerity. What's happening in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, I mean, much to the consternation of those of us that write about these things, you're not allowed to call it bankruptcy. You have to call it a bankruptcy-like process. Basically, there was a law last year passed called PROMESA. That's an acronym. It also means promise in Spanish. And it enabled the ability to put together this bankruptcy type proceeding for Puerto Rico, which suffers from roughly $70 to $73 billion in debt that was accumulated over the last decade or more through both their own mismanagement within their government, but more importantly, because their municipal debt was what is known as triple tax exempt. It was exempt from state, local, and federal taxes. So Wall Street financial interests just loved to issue Puerto Rican debt, and they pushed the island's government to do so at every step, and that led them into this chasm that they're in right now with their situation. There are also a lot of laws at the congressional level that sort of disadvantage Puerto Rico. So as a result of all of these things, there was this massive debt. Hedge funds, known on the island as vulture funds, picked up a lot of this debt at pennies on the dollar and sought a major payday. And because of the structure of the various laws on the island, they didn't have the ability to go through a bankruptcy, number one. And number two, they had some constitutional guarantees with a lot of this debt. So it seemed like a easy money for these hedge funds. So PROMESA passes. And PROMESA does two things. It allowed for this bankruptcy process. However, it put in place this fiscal oversight board, which literally on the island is known as the junta, much like, sort of almost a military dictatorship was called, like in places like Argentina in the 70s. But so the junta is made up of seven unelected members who have very authoritative control over the operations of the budget in Puerto Rico. And they pushed through, there were austerity programs already in place prior to the junta getting involved, but they mandated the Puerto Rican governor, who is mostly a servant on fiscal matters, to these unelected board members, They forced that governor to put together a plan that was really even more devastating. We were already at the sort of bare bones with Puerto Rico. But it pushed it as a necessary condition of invoking this bankruptcy-like process. They added another, I think, $40 billion in budget cutbacks, hits to the health system, the closure of another couple hundred schools, taking a lot out of higher education, like the University of Puerto Rico, which has been under strike for the last month by the students because of these cutbacks. They dropped public pension spending through converting to 401k plans from defined benefit pensions. They forced certain government operations to be privatized. They I believe by next month, by July 1st, maybe, there will be furloughs initiated for government workers. They're talking about cutting the school year by 2 months. This is an absolute disaster for the 3.5 million American citizens of Puerto Rico, many of whom have been leaving the island in droves. An average of a doctor a day has been leaving the island of Puerto Rico, and it's been a significant brain drain and talent drain. It's really only the people that have the means to leave that are leaving behind this tremendous poverty, an unemployment rate in the double digits, and really talented personnel unavailable for core services like healthcare. So this is a disaster for the people of Puerto Rico. And whatever the outcome of this bankruptcy-like process, the austerity has already, taken its toll on the island. And there doesn't seem to be anything in here that is around economic development or restoring the prospects of the people who remain on the island.
It's like a Greece inside the United States.
That's right.
We've spent an hour or so discussing the brutally exploitative politics of upward economic redistribution perpetrated by Wall Street. So I want to finish by walking listeners back from the ledge and discussing some possible alternatives. One that you've written about are public banks.
Public banking is a innovative idea. It's not a new idea in the United States. There's one existing public bank in North Dakota. It has been there for almost 100 years now. It started from some prairie populace in 1919, I believe. The way a public bank works is it takes in the deposits, in this case, of the state of North Dakota. It uses those deposits as the means to issue loans, in the case of North Dakota, for infrastructure projects of the state, also for student loans. You can come up with a number of variety of different ways in which to use public banks, affordable housing, economic development, what have you. And it offers them at a much lower rate because unlike bondholders looking for a return on these kinds of municipal projects, it does not have the need to, pay off large executive salaries or things like that. So it offers these loans at a lower rate. And not only that, but as it commissions these loans and draws its return, most of that return goes right back to the state of North Dakota as a surplus profit that then is used to cycle back into the economy of North Dakota. So this has been a very successful program. In the wake of 2008, a small group known as the Public Banking Institute tried in various locations to institute city and state-owned banks for this purpose of both lowering infrastructure costs and recycling the money in these deposits, these large deposits that cities and states hold. They're holding these deposits for you know, tax revenue before it goes back out to services. And there's kind of a way station for this various these various revenue streams. And it's hundreds of billions of dollars, and it can be used for economic development locally rather than go out to, you know, normally it's held by a Wall Street bank who then uses it for whatever purpose they want. There are some initiatives that are moving forward in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in Philadelphia, in Oakland, in Santa Rosa, California. One of the bigger ones is in the state of New Jersey, where the leading candidate on the Democratic side is running on a platform of public banking. Ironically, he's a former Goldman Sachs banker named Phil Murphy, but he sees this opportunity to use the public banking system as a way to, you know, keep sort of local resources available for local needs. And so it's a very interesting program. I wrote a feature about it for In These Times magazine. You can check that out at inthesetimes.com. You know, we will see. I think it's going to take one or two of these to actually come into force before we get a sense of whether this can become, you know, something more widespread. But certainly if you put a public bank in the shadow of Wall Street in New Jersey, that's going to capture some attention.
Wow. Well, I feel better already.
There you go.
David Day.
I aim to please.
David Day, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
David Dayan is a journalist who covers finance for a number of outlets, including The Intercept and The New Republic. He is also the author of the book Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once is reported having said, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. And also, if it's on iTunes, leave us a glowing review. As silly as it sounds, those reviews really do help introduce us to new listeners, who then listen to us and so on and so forth. So to spreading the word to your friends. Please make propaganda for us. And also, find us on Patreon.com. And make a monthly contribution to keep this thing going. Even a few bucks is really helpful.